Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The ship wasn't insured and the owners had abandoned it. So the pirates were then trying to extort money from the governments who wouldn't pay.
Welcome to Stand Up Speak Up, a Canadian-made podcast highlighting important social issues and giving a voice to remarkable people. Jay Bahadur is an investigator for an international agency. He's a Canadian born in Toronto, Ontario, who went on to be a journalist and author, becoming well known for his reporting on Somalian pirates. He got an inside look at Somali piracy after spending months in the country, living with pirates and venturing into areas that most journalists wouldn't dare visit. Jay documented his experience in a book titled The Pirates of Somalia, Inside Their Hidden World, which was released in 2011. 6 years later, in 2017, a movie by the same name was released, which closely follows Jay's story. It's also known by an alternate title, Dabka, and was directed by Brian Buckley. Jay is portrayed on screen by Evan Peters, and the film also stars Barkhad Abdi, Melanie Griffith, and Al Pacino.
I'm going to go to Somalia and write a book on the pirates.
Somalia?
AIDS.
AIDS.
Isn't that a problem there?
I'm going to write about the pirates, Dad, not sleep with them.
Okay. You know those out-of-body experiences where you look around and say, this shit isn't happening to me? My only one I could compare it to is when I got pulled over for speeding in Kitchener. Cop asked me to step out of the car because I had a blunt in the ashtray.
What is a blunt?
You know, grass. Marijuana.
That isn't tolerated in America.
I'm Canadian.
Sorry, brother. I forget.
Well, please don't forget when I get shot here. I want my body sent to the right country.
It's for USCIA.
You've got to get the hell out of here.
I'm a journalist, don't shoot! I'm a journalist, it's okay, don't shoot me!
Calm down.
Need somebody on his side! All of Somalia needs somebody on their side!
Pirates of Somalia is available now to watch, and if you'd like to check it out, you may want to do that first and then come back to this podcast episode. But whether you've seen the movie or not, you can still enjoy this interview. We think you'll find Jay very interesting, and it doesn't contain any big spoilers that would prevent you from enjoying the movie at a later time. Jay joins us today from his home in Nairobi, Kenya, to share the story of his journey, including what it was like to have a movie made about his life, how he got the pirates to open up and talk, whether or not the movie was true to his book, and more.
The first thing is, how does it feel to get a movie made about you?
Well, I didn't really believe it until about a month ago, or 2 months ago, whenever it actually came out in theaters. You know, when I wrote the book, a number of parties approached to discuss movie rights, and, you know, I talked to them and finally signed the option with this one company, Hungry Man. But you never really expect it to happen. I mean, something like 2-5% of movies get made. So it wasn't something that was really part of my life until, I think at the moment it became really part of my life was when they told me Al Pacino had signed on. Then it became really quite real. But it's very, in terms of how it felt, it's certainly very, you know, you're kind of exposing yourself, making yourself vulnerable, similar to writing a book, I guess. But in a way, with a book, you can control what's on the page. Nothing is going to be on the page, you know, in the end that you don't want to be there. But when you're signing sort of your life story to that point, there's a lot of factors you can't control. So that was very nerve-wracking, obviously, because this is even more than the book. This was sort of how I was going to be portrayed to the world. So it was exciting. It was nerve-wracking. I loved learning about the movie industry. I've actually started writing a screenplay now that I've been bitten by the bug. On something totally unrelated, but I really enjoyed the process of getting to be part of the movie in a little way, having a 10-second cameo. I don't know if you noticed, but I get shot in the movie in a nightmare sequence. I get executed on the runway. So all that was really fun, and in the end, I was really happy with the final product, and I was happy that they stayed true to the story and didn't try to sensationalize it or portray Somalia in a different way than I had portrayed it in the book, which was really meant a lot to me.
But there was no Al Pacino character, correct? And there was no girl that you were kind of in love with that you became connected with.
Right. So to answer the first part, the Al Pacino character was kind of a pastiche. His character and then the Avril Benoit character, who is a real person, of course, they had components. I guess it's not a pastiche, it's the opposite of a pastiche, where one character has been split into multiple characters. I don't know what you call that. But yeah, those Avril Benoit and the Al Pacino character, Seymour, were kind of sort of different elements of the same person. In a way, I did speak to a lot of journalists over the course of deciding to go to Somalia and got their opinion. And the views put forth by the Al Pacino character certainly were sort of the consensus of what I heard from the people I talked to, including Avril Benoit. In terms of the Marianne character, so her existence is very real. She's everything about her biography is real. She was the wife of the pirate lord Garad. She sold cat in the market. And she was, her and Garad had this kind of thing called a pleasure marriage, where just kind of in Islam, a way of getting around actual marriage and just want, if you want to have casual sex or whatnot, you get married for a temporary amount of time. And some people even argue you can divorce over text message. So that's, I think, the arrangement they had. But the romantic interest, yeah, that was a dramatic license. I had a long-term girlfriend at the time. In Canada. So that aspect of it was fictional.
Well, I was thinking, like, were you relieved there was no sex scene? Like, were you like, oh God, if there's a sex scene, it's going to be like, everybody's going to see me, because a lot of movies have like intense sex scenes.
I thought that's the way they might go with it, but they didn't. And, I didn't really think, I wasn't really too worried about that, except maybe my ex-girlfriend would think that I had an affair, thing that I hadn't told her about. But I wasn't really too worried about that. And in the end, actually, when I saw what they'd done with it and how they had just made it come almost, quite platonic, really, in the end, I found a lot of the people messaging me about the movie were still very intrigued with that story. Where is she? Where is she now? What's become of her? And unfortunately, I don't have too much to tell. Next time I'm in Somalia in Garoway, I have to ask around, see what became of her, because there's a lot of people who want to know. So
I know. Well, I did look up, kind of saying, like, it just did. Some of the interviews did kind of say it wasn't as romantic as they would have said it was. But every story, every leading man needs a female interest, right? Isn't that the whole thing? And every leading woman needs a male interest. So they had to just check that off for doing their movie.
Yeah, it was funny. I think they were looking for that so intensely in the book, and there wasn't really anything to lead them anywhere except this footnote about Marianne. So they actually created her out of a footnote.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Now, okay. How did your mom feel about Melanie Griffiths playing her? Was she pretty excited?
It was funny. Both my parents at the after party after the premiere in Tribeca in April were running around to all the cast and the crew and the director and producer at the party, saying, "No, I wouldn't have said this or I wouldn't have said that."
Oh my God, really? They're probably like, "Yeah, this is why we don't have them on the set with us."
Yeah, I had to say to them, it's not about you. It's not really even about replicating my character, because the Evan Peters portrayal, he went his own way with that. And they certainly went their own way with my parents as well. And it was hard to explain that, they stayed very true to the story, but they consciously didn't try and sort of, replicate us as if they're doing biopics of us or anything like that. And that was totally fair. I mean, we're not, well-known people. So, they made that decision, and I was fine with that, as long as the kind of the story kept its integrity, and I think it very much did. So I think Evan Peters, for example, we had one Skype conversation before filming started, and I think after that conversation, he decided to completely do his own thing.
But I mean, like, at least you got a hot guy playing you. Right? Like, weren't you like, yeah, okay, good, I got a hot guy that's like pretty famous.
I think he did a good job, but just, you know, I didn't really see myself in that character. But again, that didn't bother me. It wasn't like, that wasn't sort of a requirement for me by any means. And I think my parents, for their part, probably expected more of a lifelike portrayal of themselves, even though they had never been interviewed for the movie or anything. So it was a strange expectation.
Well, I think it's hilarious because Melanie looks so far from a Canadian style mom. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm watching it, I'm like, okay, man, at least you should be wearing Lululemon or something. But I'm watching and I'm thinking, man, like, you don't have the Canadian style figured out at all.
Malibu, like Housewives of Malibu or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, okay, well, maybe this will make Toronto seem like a much more California-esque place. Okay, what would you say was so different from your personality to the one portrayed in the movie? Like, what were you just like, that is so not me? And versus, yeah, that is like me.
I don't think, like, I'm not nearly as flamboyant. I'm not as likely to sort of start screaming or losing my head in a way as sort of it's portrayed in the movie. When put in really awkward situations or dangerous situations, my instinct is more to go introverted than to...
Not jump out of the car and be like, take me on board to the small ship.
Yeah, exactly. So that whole scene was pretty accurate, you know, pretty true to life in terms of what happened in that town. But there wasn't any like yelling and screaming, you know, because that's very easy way to get shot in small. In fact, when I saw the movie, I half thought that he was going to get shot during that.
You're like, oh shit, like this is going bad.
Even though I know how it ends, but anyway.
What I find interesting is that you titled the books actually Pirates, but that wasn't how they wanted to be called. Did you title it The Pirates of Somalia just because you knew that's what would get more sales? Like, were you ever tempted to not call it The Pirates?
The thing is that it's not really up to the author, to be honest, titles of the book. I mean, the publishers they of course take your input, but in the end, they'll pick what they think is going to sell well. So it actually does have a different title in the UK market. It's called Deadly Waters there, because for whatever reason that the UK editors thought that that would perform better in their market. And it's called Deadly Waters in Australia as well. But ultimately, you know, I went back and forth with the editors for months about the title. The original title, the working title, was The Pirates of Puntland, which I thought worked better as a sort of alliteration until they pointed out that no one knows what Puntland is. So, but yeah, really, I can't really sort of tell you how many or overstate how many hours we put into trying to think of a title different than, more interesting than The Pirates of Somalia. But in the end, it checked the boxes, you know? So, yeah, that's what we went with, at least in the Canadian and American markets.
Well, it's definitely catchy. I mean, everybody is fascinated by pirates for centuries and centuries, right? So everybody loves a good pirate story. It's just interesting how they don't see themselves as pirates. They see themselves as like protectors of the seas, supporting the community. Do they still see themselves like that, do you think?
Well, I mean, there hasn't been too much pirate activity lately. In my current job, I do some work on what's left of piracy. So there were a few attacks last year. I interviewed some pirates, and certainly they still have that narrative of we were fishermen. In most cases, they don't even admit that they did anything wrong. They just say we were fishermen and we were sort of attacked by whoever and captured and whatnot. So that narrative is still, from what I can see, is still there. But yeah, I think the view of many Somalis is that, yes, they were protecting their seas. I think, too, that's not my view. So if I were to put that on a title, not only would it not sell well, but I think it would sort of be disingenuous in terms of what I actually think and believe based on the work I did. And also a title like The Saviors of the Sea of Somalia doesn't quite...
No.
And it would certainly be, I think it would not represent, you know, what the book argues and what I think.
Do you have any friends still, like any of your friends that you met over there, or any pirates that you would call a friend that you could still call up? And I mean, do you still have quite a few contacts out there?
I certainly have a lot of contacts in Somalia. In terms of the pirates, there's one, Boya, who's in the movie very prominently. last I heard, I go to Garaway a lot, which is his hometown, and for work. So I currently go there, you know, every so often for work. And last I heard, he become blind and was a preacher, was an imam in a mosque in Garaway. So that to me is like quite an interesting development. And I was hoping to look him up. I haven't been able to yet, but next time I'm there, I'm going to try and meet up with him. Because he was certainly the one with the most sort of moral depth, and you know, he was older. He was kind of had more. I'd say he was a more sympathetic character than many of the pirates who came around later. As in, he was actually a fisherman. He actually had his livelihood disrupted by foreign fishers and this kind of thing. And I think he was genuinely trying to reform. And I don't know what happened to him. He was, as reported in the movie, he was arrested and put in jail for about 3 or 4 years and then released. And as I said, now he apparently is a preacher. So he's someone I definitely want to follow up with. Garad, the other main pirate in the movie, was killed some years ago on a mission. He was one of the few kingpins who would still go out at sea and participate in the hijackings. And he was killed by the Iranian Navy some years ago. So, yeah, most of the other guys I interviewed were kind of lower down and didn't, I guess, make as much of an impression on me. So in short, I don't really keep tabs on the pirates, but I do obviously still have many contacts and friends in Puntland in general, and I still work there frequently.
And the drug that you talk about a lot, Kata, that they sell in the market, what is it like? Like, what would it compare to in our drug terms?
It's like somewhere between coffee and cocaine, something like that.
Okay.
It's just a stimulant. It makes you very talkative, you know, makes you sweat, makes you feel like grind your teeth, that kind of thing. But in terms of a drug, I mean, it's quite, you know, vile to taste, to eat, and you really have to be committed to it. So, and then chew it for hours and hours and hours. So I wouldn't recommend it necessarily.
Well, if so, why do they take it? Does it give them energy? Like, does it relax you? Because it doesn't seem relaxing the way you're explaining it. It seems like it makes you agitated or more intense.
Definitely makes people agitated. It actually, there's been some studies into the effect of cod just in conflict in Somalia, because these militias are often chewing cod regularly, and it certainly, I think, well, the argument's been made very convincingly that it certainly resulted in sort of increased pirate violence, brutality towards the crews. But it also creates a sense of euphoria, you know. It certainly gives energy, makes talking more enjoyable, gives, like I said, a mild euphoria. So it's a drug, people, you know, and it's addictive. So if you're doing it every day, you might need it just to be normal. It's the case with a lot of drugs, you know. You might feel depressed or not able to function if you don't have it. So yeah, and there's just not too much else available in Somalia. You know, obviously alcohol is extremely limited and very taboo.
You mentioned in the movie and in your book that it was good to give to the pirates so they would talk more, but would it also make them, as you said, more violent? Like, would it ever make them more unpredictable for you when they would be offered kata?
I mean, no, we would be in just very relaxed situations, so I don't think it would go that way. I'm having a lounge under a tree or in a living room. It wasn't in a tense situation. So I just think it would have a chance of exacerbating things if people were stressed, like if they're sitting on a ship, can't, you know, haven't been able to leave for months, you know, are being buzzed by American helicopters, that kind of thing. That's sort of where it might have a chance to or have an effect of creating violence or making someone more unpredictable.
What was your tactic to get the pirates to talk to you? How would you engage the conversation?
Well, the first thing was, as portrayed in the movie, I was essentially being hosted by the cousins of these pirates. And so the Farole family was, I'm not saying they were pirates, but they were the same subclan as many of the early pirates. So first off, I was a guest, sort of a guest of their clan and the president of the country, not the country, but of Puntland, who was hosting me, or his family was. So there was that. And in terms of trying to engage them, I mean, also as portrayed in the movie, it was sort of key not to just call them pirates and say, you're doing all this. Just like anyone, or certainly any person engaged in criminal or illicit activity, you might start by saying, asking about their life, early life, their families, you know, why they went down this road, and, you know, not be accusatory, like just be, you know, just be interested in their lives. And, you know, generally, if you're interested in someone's life, you know, they like talking, you know, look at you and me, right? people like talking about their lives. And I can't even begin to think of all the mistakes I made over there. But I think I definitely, over the weeks and months, developed a better interviewing technique where I was more able to get them to open up.
In the movie, they touch on when, you know, you were feeling stressed and anxious. What were the times when you felt, I can't do this anymore. I'm like so done. I want to get out of here. I'm depressed. Nothing's going my way. What am I doing?
It was actually, I mean, the movie kind of portrayed me as locked in a room. And while it wasn't exactly like that, it wasn't, you know, in a way, because there were days and days I would sit without even being able to leave the room. You know, I would, you know, before going to Somalia, I smoked occasionally, but now there I really started like chain smoking almost, just because I was so on edge, couldn't leave, couldn't do anything. And part of the problem was, like, talk about naivete. You know, I didn't even bring my own phone. Like, I didn't have my own phone for the first trip I was there. I didn't have my own SIM. So I was totally relying on other people to, like, make calls for me. I mean, it was ridiculous looking back. And, there were certainly times when I thought, yeah, this isn't going anywhere. And I wanted to leave. I, you know, beg people just to take me out for a walk or a run or something. You know, I would exercise back home. I'd exercise regularly. I couldn't exercise really in Somalia. So that all added up. The internet barely worked. So it was really hard to even do research, you know, on my computer. It was tough at times, but it was also the times that were, things did happen, you know, then they really happened fast and furious. So it was always kind of looking forward to the next time I'd be able to go out. I guess it was like being in prison in a way. The family that hosted me, the Farole family, they were absolutely paranoid about anything happening to me, and rightfully so, because it was, you know, it would come back to them. And my partner's father was the president of Puntland, so he was. They were all very conscious of creating some sort of an incident. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that they were very protective.
When you were out there and you had to learn all these coping skills for dealing with all this discomfort, I guess, who were you when you came back? So who was Jay pre going and doing all this, and then post Jay?
Well, I know I was a lot lighter. I was about 40 pounds lighter. So physically, that's how things change when you're not eating very much and you're chain smoking. I think I felt like a journalist coming back. You know, when I went in there, I felt like I was sort of a fraud, a complete interloper in a way, as is expressed in the movie. And when I came back, I felt like I was part of that journalist community in a way. And I had an identity. And then when I went to Kenya in December, after I'd spent all that time in Somalia, and I was sort of welcomed into the journalist community here, that really sealed the deal. And I guess that's what really, in a way, attracted me to Kenya as well, is that I felt part of the community for the, you know, first time in terms of community of professionals. You know, like I had an identity. I knew what I was, and I could tell people I was a journalist and I wasn't completely, just full of it. So I guess that was probably the biggest change. Certainly an increase in confidence and increase in sort of belief in where my future was going. So that was probably the biggest change, thinking back.
Do you think this movie has opened new doors for you?
Well, like I said, I'm working on a screenplay, and I hope to finish it soon. When I do, I'm hoping to kind of use some of the connections I made with this movie, trying to get it on the right desks. But this is just a side project. It's not something I see myself doing long term. It was just kind of a desire to get back into writing after, or creative writing, after a long stint of not doing any. So, yeah, it's an avenue that I want to pursue, and who knows where it'll go, but it's not something I'm betting my future on or anything.
Have you ever thought, I'd love to have a podcast just like this one? Well, I can help. My name is Matt Kundel, and everyone at my company, the Sound Off Podcast Network, had a hand in making this show. Whether it was about the sound, the discoverability, or that you're just enjoying the show, we are all about the detail. If you think you have a podcast in you, reach out to me via email, matt@soundoff.network, or check out the website and become one of the great podcasts we work with at soundoff.network.
In just a moment, we'll get back to Jay as he gives some further insight on Somali pirates and a story of a ship being overtaken where the owners refused to pay up. First, wanted to quickly let you know about a way that you can help support what we do here on the Stand Up Speak Up podcast, and that is to leave us a quick review on iTunes. It doesn't cost you a cent, but it does help us grow our audience. We're doing very well on the iTunes charts, so thank you very much for listening each week. And to leave a review, just click onto the Stand Up Speak Up page on iTunes. We hope that you'll give us a 5-star rating and leave a sentence or two about why you enjoy the podcast. And of course, we are always open to suggestions and ideas for guests as well. We're always listening on Facebook at Stand Up Speak Up Podcast. Thank you very much. And now back to Carla's interview with Jay Bahadur.
How many of the Somali pirates, like, actually murdered other people? Or what did they kill people?
There was a few instances where crew members were actually executed. I guess it depends what you mean by. There were the different levels of killing, I guess. So in one case, a ship that I was looking at, in fact, a crew member had been shot in the boarding. So he'd been hit by a stray bullet, I think, or at least a bullet, not intended to directly hit and hurt someone, but had been hit. And I can't remember if he was killed or not. There are a few cases where, yeah, people were actually executed as a message. And then there were cases where people were driven, crew members were driven to suicide. So that would consider that a form of murder. You had cases where people were kept for years and died of illness. Again, would be a form of murder, obviously. So there are different levels of what pirates, you know, the consequences of their actions were. But it wasn't common for them to actually intentionally kill people.
So when you talk about driven to suicide just because the people felt there was no hope when the pirates came on board and they were being starved, or...
Well, the example I'm thinking of, it was a case where they had been on board for 2 years or something, and I guess the guy, you know, understandably just broke and killed himself. I don't think it was over something in particular, aside the fact that he had been held on the ship for 2 years.
So he was held on the ship. What country was he from?
I don't remember. It may have been Pakistan or India.
Okay, interesting. So why didn't they let him go? They were waiting for the money to come. After 2 years, wouldn't you kind of be like,
Yeah, again, good question. I think in this particular case, the ship wasn't insured and the owners had abandoned it. So the thing is, the pirates were then trying to extort money from the governments who wouldn't pay. And so in the end, I think what happened was there was some private fundraising and they finally got them off. But I guess they had been abandoned, and I guess this particular person, there may have been more than maybe two people that committed suicide, one or two who I guess didn't really hold out any hope. But yeah, that was a rare case. I mean, it was a rare case. And the pirates, why they didn't let it go is because the problem is when they, first, they don't really believe that there's no money. So if they're told that this is a shipping company, doesn't have insurance or they've abandoned it, they won't believe it, number one. Number two, they owe people, because during the whole operation, they're taking credit to buy cot, to buy food, other supplies, fuel. So they owe potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars over the course of this time, and they need to pay it back. So in a way, their backs are against the wall. So there were a number of cases like this where the ship was abandoned, which really you saw the worst effects and consequences of pirates, trying out.
And what about sexual assault in the pirates? Would that happen? How prevalent would that be?
Very few merchant mariners are women, so that's one thing. In terms of sexual assault against men, I'm not sure. I did one case where I was following the Victoria, which is the ship that's portrayed off Ale in the movie. Did have a woman on board, and I asked about that, and they told me no, they never bothered her. They treated her with respect and blah blah. In fact, there was at one point there was a pirate manual discovered on board. I can't remember the details, but it was some like code of conduct that some pirates had put together for their crew. And one of the things was like, don't sexually abuse anyone. So I don't know how faithfully that was carried out or how widespread that was, but I certainly didn't hear There are no cases that stick out in my mind of sexual assault, but obviously that's not saying it didn't happen.
And the cruise ships, many times they have the water that sprays out, and as they go through the waters, do you know of cases where they attack cruise ships?
Yeah, early on there was a few where they kind of fired some RPGs at cruise ships. I don't think any cruise ships were hijacked, but then I imagine that was very early on. So afterwards, I imagine they just completely avoided the area, would be my guess. I don't think any cruise company would even take a slight chance of having having a boat hijacked with hundreds of civilians on board.
So can I ask you what your screenplay is about? Are you allowed to give an idea or no?
Yeah, I'm writing about it's a historical drama set in ancient Rome, but it's about a hypothetical Roman intelligence service set in the reign of Caligula. So essentially, it's about a couple Roman spies and then they're caught up in this whole web to assassinate Caligula. So it's just a little passion of mine, Roman history. So I'm just indulging in a little fantasy.
We'll put links to find out more about Jay and follow the updates on his screenplay in the show notes for this episode at standupspeakupblog.com, along with links to his book and the movie trailer. Thanks for listening to Stand Up Speak Up, and in our bonus content today, our quick wrap-up discussion for this episode as Carla shares what got her interested in Jay's story and why she is fascinated by investigative journalism.
Low, when you're feeling low, when you just don't know where to run to. Broke, if your heart's been broke and you feel like you're all alone. You need something to believe in. If you're looking for a light to guide you home, just look inside. Your light is shining brighter than you know. And you should know, I'm never gonna let you down. I'm always gonna build you up. When you're feeling lost, I will always find your love. Never gonna walk away. I'm always gonna have your back. Don't that. When you need me, I promise I will never let you down.
Thanks for listening to our music selection today. That was Ain't Never Gonna Let You Down, performed by Linda Nuska. This was pretty fascinating because up front, when I first, you know, you first brought this story to me about Jay, I assumed it all sounded crazy because he went to get an inside look at these pirates' lives. And I just thought, how do you do that without getting killed? So it was a dangerous situation. But what did you think of how it came across? It wasn't that crazy, it didn't seem, afterwards they would actually talk to him.
Yeah, I think he's probably very charismatic and he's probably very much a chameleon that can probably be in any situation and talk his way through it. And he's probably very unassuming, I think, because he was the first journalist to ever get to talk to pirates. Like, none of the big guys had ever done that before. That's what I found so fascinating about his story, is that he was just so tenacious and just so driven and so determined. And he was willing to put himself on the line, you know, his own life on the line to get the story.
Yeah, I was thinking that had to be nerve-wracking for his parents, even, because he said in the interview how there was, of course, not great internet over there a lot of the time. So he was just gone for weeks, months at a time, and not really in contact that much with home.
I mean, when I first watched the movie, like, Al and I were home, and Al's my husband, and we couldn't find a movie to agree on, so we picked that one. And as soon as I heard that he was Canadian, I got super interested, because I love when Canadians do cool stuff, right? Who doesn't, right? When it's a Canadian, I'm like, oh my God, like, wow. And he's from my hometown, even better, right? And I just was like, so impressed that he saw that he just couldn't make inroads in his own country and he needed to do something completely insane to move up the ladder as a journalist. And I guess part of me saw myself like that when I had to move to China to make inroads in telecom. You know, like, I knew that Canada was kind of a boring country business-wise. They weren't very, risky. They don't really have that kind of maverick, fearless attitude here. So I felt I had to even leave the country at his same age. We both left our countries in the same age. Now, I didn't go into a pirate situation. And so I guess for him doing that, I just like totally was impressed by him. Like, I was like, wow, he kicks ass. Like, what a cool guy.
The lengths he was willing to go to get his story.
Yeah, my husband was like, what a stupid guy. How can you be so impressed, Carla? The guy, like, imagine his parents freaking out, he didn't even think of anybody else's feelings, how that would impact them. But I just kept going, oh man, that's great. You know, he really just, I don't know, like, lived dangerously, I guess.
I'm drawing some correlation here to the while back when we did the Finding Shelley series, and a certain podcast host was climbing through the basements of crack houses.
I know. I mean, I think that I feel like in this, it's really strange, but I feel like a big part of journalism is investigative journalism. And I'll never consider myself a journalist. Obviously, I don't consider myself that. But I feel like investigative journalism is really the real journalism. And I know that a lot of people would give me flack for that. I just feel like doing something that somebody else wouldn't do to tell a story is like super cool. You know, I think, like, and I know that maybe I can't do this, but in my mind, I dream of a time that I could go and do investigative journalism on female cartel leaders. So females that are super high in the criminal underworld, and because it's very male dominated, the criminal underworld, but there are a few female that have made it to the top, and I would just love to interview them and see how they work and just understand how they were able to get to the top. That would be my ultimate investigative piece.
It is fascinating to finally learn about a lot of these things that are out there that we can't access for whatever reason. Like, in these cases, it's just too dangerous or nobody looked. So to have someone go in and take the risk and get that that story to share with everyone that we've never really heard before, of course, you know, like in Jay's case, it was very well received. He had a lot of response from it. Everybody wanted to talk to him and, you know, ended up into a movie.
Yeah. And deservingly so, because I think I believe that investigative journalism should be should be paid for, because a journalist telling a story is very different than a lawyer telling a story or a police telling a story or somebody that works in the front lines telling the story. It comes from a very different perspective, usually of no judgment. Like, he didn't really take a judgment, good or bad, about the pirates. Like, he wasn't like he'd be a police officer saying like what they did was wrong, or be a government official that was like challenging what they were doing. He was just telling the audience like the reality of the situation. That's what's so cool about journalism and investigative journalism.
Thanks again for listening to Stand Up Speak Up. This has been our interview with Jay Bahadur. You can find us online at standupspeakupblog.com, and we'll see you next time.
I'm Matt Kundel, host of the Sound Off Podcast, the show about podcast and broadcast. Since 2016, we've been speaking with amazing people who have populated your ears for decades. Legendary broadcasters, research wizards, talent experts, podcasters, voice talent. Almost 400 stories, all for free. Subscribe or follow the Sound Off Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at soundoffpodcast.com.